My name's Melissa. I'm an alcoholic. So, yeah, it's really odd to be standing up here. You know, when I was drinking, I used to love to be the center of attention. I loved the spotlight. I loved your attention. And now it's like, oh, my God. I thought I was prepared, but I'm really not. So what it was like, I grew up in a family of alcoholics and drug addicts, and I mention both because it's part of my story. My first sip of alcohol was when I was old enough to push a chair to the refrigerator like I'd seen my sister do and get my dad's Olympia beers that were up on top of the shelf, you know, in the door. And he'd say, Melissa, go in there and give me a beer. He'd be out working in, you know, on his cars or whatever. Mom would be in the house. They'd always be fighting, always separated. So, you know, I was a good little girl, and can I have a sip? All right, just one. So I, that beer. And that first sip, oh, my God, it was horrible. But how it made me feel was the thing, how it made me feel. I never fit in. I had this, I just never fit in anywhere. I didn't fit in with my family. I didn't fit in with the world. I was always uncomfortable, neurotic little kid, overachiever. If the good grades didn't get it, then the bad grades might. Attention, you know, performing. I grew up performing. And that was in, you know, like auditoriums like this, you know, on stage and stuff from a very young age. And so I would get those accolades, and I would go home feeling like, you know, I cuss a lot, so sorry for the little kids. I felt horrible about myself, you know. Even if I was told that was an okay job, because with my mother it was never good enough, and with my dad it didn't matter. So I always strive for that feeling. That feeling that I got from alcohol. And so I kept drinking. And intermittently, you know, I'd have sips of my dad's beer, and then my Aunt Tommy Jo would say, Melissa, go out and make me a cocktail. And I was like 8 or 9. I was old enough to get in the trunk of her car. She'd give me the keys, and she had a big ice chest, you know, with her liquor bottles. And I know it was Maker's Mark. I know it was Jack Daniels. I know it was whiskeys, because that's what Aunt Tommy, she drank. And she'd always, you know, with her highballs and her, you know, it was always so beautiful, the red fingernails. And I want to be just like Aunt Tommy Jo. And I bit my nails, you know, because I was neurotic and nervous. So, you know, I was always wanting to change who I was, always wanting to change that crappy feeling inside of never belonging. And alcohol was the first drug of choice. And then it became, you know, whatever anybody was sharing with me, that's what I would do. I would smoke pot. I was never a pot smoker, but I would smoke it because that's what everybody was doing. So my drinking continued through high school, and I was a pretty much a party binger then. I would do the keggers, and I'd outlast all the guys, you know, because I wanted to fit in with everybody. And puke and rally, that was a big deal for me. I was the puke and rally girl. And, you know, I could throw up and keep going. And that was my sickness. I mean, it's just so sick now. And I was speaking with a friend of mine who knew me in college in my 30s. I was a grown woman with 3 kids, you know, and didn't realize even then that I had a problem with anything. I mean, because I was so busy numbing it that I didn't know who the hell I was. You know, so I was just kind of spinning around in the world, and why won't anybody love me? I just want to be loved, not realizing that I was loved from the beginning. With something that is so much more powerful than me and my spirituality. That's the thing. I had a spiritual malady that I didn't realize. I was always blaming everybody else and always trying to please everybody else. And if you would just love me, I wouldn't drink. If you just loved me, I wouldn't have to smoke that, or I wouldn't have to snort that, you know, blaming everybody. And so it progressed, because it's progressive. And it progressed quickly. I mean, I just didn't even realize. I was able to have a cocktail, you know. I was able to have a vodka gimlet up with Cointreau once a year at dinner, you know, in my 20s. In my 30s, it became I had to get drunk in the mornings in order to get up to go to my classes, to make it through the day, to go back to serving alcohol in the evenings to get through my classes. And it was this vicious cycle. And so it didn't make it easier that my family was all about the drugs and alcohol. That was just how I grew up. That was normal. And so if I didn't do drugs and alcohol, then I was the outcast and the oddball. And so obviously I wanted to fit in, so that's what I did. But in my 30s, I did manage to get through school, a little bit of college, and I got a great job. And then the arrogance and conceit that came along with my drinking and the, you know, I don't know any of you. I don't want to know any of you. I just want to do my job and go home so that I can party more, so I can feel better about me, so I can go back and do it again. And the insanity was just that. It was just so insane. And now I, coming to AA, it just got, I mean, the incomprehensible demoralization. I forget who read that. It might have been Mary or Julie, but or Jacob. Thank you again for reading. The incomprehensible demoralization of myself. I couldn't look at myself in the mirror in the mornings and believe who I'd become. So I would drink some more so that I could feel okay for half a day. And then in my 40s, I was told by a bunch of people, you know, I was a bartender because I quit the great job, you know, because I couldn't drink and go to work. So I got a job as a bartender. That was perfect because I was expected to drink with my customers on the job. And that's what I did. For everyone they got, I'd drink too. And I was, my tolerance was so high at that point that I could drink a lot. And I say that like I'm proud of it. But it's such an embarrassment, and I don't know how to respond to that except with, you know, like this crazy, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if any of you understand that feeling, but I'm so shameful. My behavior was so shameful. And in the very end, I had was living with a man who said to me, well, are you just going to keep gaining weight? You know, there's a trigger. And so, no, I'm not. Oh, I'm going to partake in some other things, and you're not going to know about it. And I'm going to be thin and trim, and I'm going to be everything you want me to be because that's what I was taught, and that's what I believed. And so I started doing other things and drinking, which allowed me to do more drinking. I could stay up for a long time then. And was told I had a problem with alcohol, so I went to one meeting a week for 7 months and stayed sober, and then he drank. And, you know, that's kind of a impossible mix. So I had to make a decision. When I finally left where I was living, my daughter had said to me, you ever drink again and I'm never coming home. And she was 16, and the first couple of days I didn't drink because she said she wouldn't come home, and I needed the money, right, because I was on welfare at that point. So, shit, I better not drink. And she came home, and at 16 years old, I decided that I needed to stay sober to live because I was at the jumping off point, which they talk about in the big book, where I couldn't stay drunk and I couldn't be sober. And the only way for me to manage a life for myself without wanting to die was to quit drinking and to come to meetings and to get a sponsor or three or four. Which has been my case. I consider all of my friends my sponsors because they've taught me so much about living through sobriety. And it's amazing that I wake up today and I can actually feel good about me, that I don't have to worry what I did last night because I was a blackout drinker in the end. I couldn't stop. I drank to not feel, to not be here. And so it's amazing to me that today I can actually go to breakfast or make breakfast, that I can brush my hair and brush my teeth. I mean, I neglected myself to so many extremes. And it's interesting because I see other women and other men that are out in the world that are doing this to themselves, and I just want to shake them, you know. Even though I know that that's not the AA way, we circle with love and we circle with support. But I have that frustration still. I have all my issues still. I haven't magically, you know, gotten over them all. I suffer this every single day I wake up. I have to keep my spiritual self okay. Because if I don't have anybody greater than me, I mean, please, my best decisions got me here. So I have to have a belief in a power greater than Melissa, or I keep doing what I'm doing. I may stay sober, but I'm still going to be miserable. And I didn't get sober to be miserable. I want to have a life. I want to see my grandkids grow up. I want to go to my son's wedding and not have to worry, oh, shit, you know, I'm going to have to toast. What am I going to toast with? You know, I don't have to have a buddy system right now. I may in 2 months when it comes time for the partying and all of that, because it's so easy for me to be like you said, complacent and just say, oh, I can have just one. I mean, I think about me, the times I used to say I can have just one, or, I mean, it was never just one. It might be one for 10 minutes, but it's going to be a half a bottle by the end of the night, putting myself in these situations. So my spiritual malady, I have to stay fit every single morning. I have to pray for my family because they did the best they could. It's taken me a long time and a lot of help to be able to say that. They grew up in the same dysfunction that I did. And my parents did the best they could. They may have done a shitty job, but it was the best they could. And my higher power forgives me for my trespasses because God knows how I trespassed against all of you. Liar, thief, you name it, I did it. Use sex as a weapon, use sex as a tool. I just used people left and right to change how I felt. And if you're new here, please keep coming back. I've been sober since November 8th of 2016, and I do the deal every single day, and I pray for everybody in my prayers at night. And I pray for myself now. I mean, I it took me a long time to be able to do that. I didn't feel like I deserved anything good for how I behaved. And it turns out, by being here and listening to other stories, you got a lot of stories like mine. They might be a little different, but I have a family here where your stories make me feel like, wow, okay, I'm either not so bad or maybe I'm even worse, you know, but at least I know where I belong. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous and other programs. If I need a meeting and there's not an AA meeting, which there usually is, but if there isn't, I go to NA meetings. I go to a meeting because I know that I need to maintain the center that I found with the understanding of this universe, that I'm just so small. And if I love people, if I can love myself and then love others, then maybe somebody else will want to recover and say, you know what? I can do this. Because you can do it. If I can do it, and I know Jesse M always says that, if he can make it, anybody can make it. I believe that about myself. If I can make it, anybody can make it. Because I did not want to get sober. I did not. I just knew it was the end of the road. And so I don't know how long I've shared, but, oh, thank you, Bill. Thank you for asking me to share, by the way. I just don't, there's an initial hesitation, a nervousness. But then I look around and you're all my family. I may not know some of you at all, but welcome here, because I can go anywhere and feel like a part of you. So my name's Melissa, and I am an alcoholic, and thanks for letting me share. We're going to have a 10-minute break, and then we'll be back for the speaker.
Okay. Now,
I would like to introduce the main speaker, Patty B. from Bakersfield.
Okay, I brought notes. Are you ready? My name's Patty. I'm an alcoholic. I am definitely in the right place. My sobriety date is October the 13th, 1977. Thank you. That's a gift we all get, one day at a time. I was born in Fresno, and I was raised in Clovis, small ranching community at the time. My father was a mechanic, and my mother a stenographer. And I had an older half-brother and and two younger brothers. So I was, out of the three of us, I was the oldest, just because my older half-brother lived in Missouri most of his life. So he came to live with us. And I was 2 1/2 when he arrived, and within a very short period of time, he began to sexually abuse me. My father also did the same. I tell you that not so that you can feel sorry for me at all. In fact, it's been a wonderful gift in the long run. But because you understand when someone has been sexually abused, first thing you lose is your innocence. The second thing is trust in the human beings that are supposed to care for you. And your sense of safety and security, it's gone. And if you know anything about relationships, without those things, you're very much destined not to, very much destined not to have good and healthy relationships. And I also talk about it so that you understand the fertile emotional ground on which the alcohol was poured once I got to that point in my life. I was a shy child. I had a lot of friends, but I still was very shy, painfully shy. I loved living in Clovis in a small town, and at the same time, I could hardly wait to grow up and get out of there because people could see me, and I didn't want to be seen. It was real important to be invisible. I remember almost being hit by a car on my bicycle as an adult, and I had a red sweater on, and I'm thinking to myself, how is it that you missed me on a bicycle with a red sweater on? And then he backed up and almost hit me again. And I went to my spiritual teacher. I said, what? He said, you think you're invisible, but you're not. That was a big rude awakening, and I had about 14 or 15 years of sobriety at that time. I wanted to start talking about my first experience, and thank you, Melissa, very much, because it was similar to yours. I was with my first husband, and he just graduated from tech school, and we went to the NCO club, and I had never drank before. I had no idea what to order. And the guy across from us ordered this really pretty little drink, kind of looked like orange juice. And I said to him, well, you know, when you're shopping, it has to look pretty. So I said to him, what are you drinking? He said, a whiskey sour. I said, oh, is it good? Oh, yeah, I like them. Oh, all right. So I ordered a whiskey sour. Well, the first time out, I ordered 12 more. And I counted them. Normal drinkers don't do that, I've come to find out. And I loved, absolutely loved that euphoria. Everything Melissa described, I went, yeah. I felt okay. Not better than, just okay. For one of the first times in my whole life, I was okay. I was pretty. I was pleasant. I could talk to anyone. I mean, everything got lubricated, right? And all was good. And I was concerned before I went that my husband's, buddies in the service wouldn't like me, and therefore I'd be a bad example of who he chose to marry. Let's put it this way. My first thought after I'm, wasted was I know why my mother didn't want me to drink. Because I think she innately knew that I was going to love it. I had that kind of interesting little alcoholic personality, self-centered to the max. She used to say to me, Patty, you wear your feelings on your shoulder. And I would say, no, I don't. And, of course, they'd be sitting there talking to me, judging me. It was like I had a judge constantly on my shoulder. When I started my college career, I finished my undergraduate. I was doing my graduate work. And we broke into to couples to work, and the guy, I didn't know this guy's name, I'd never seen him before. Our job was to sit there and tell each other what we saw in the other person. The first thing out of this guy's mouth was, I see that judge that sits on your shoulder all the time wagging his finger. And I went, oh my God, how could he see that? I don't even know this person, and they see that. Freaked me out. I wanted nothing to do with him or anybody else in that class. Because again, I'm invisible, right? You do not see me. You just think you do. I want to move to the price that I paid for my drinking. It cost me a lot. It cost me both of my marriages. The first one is a really nice guy. I love him today, just not in love with him. He's just a good human being. He's the father of my son. And I went out on him. I got drunk, and I just went out. And I went out, and I went out, and I went out. And when he caught me, that was it. There was no second chances. One of the guys I was going out with, we turned around and we got married. So I've married two Air Force men. So I did my stint in the Air Force. I contributed. He turned out to be a transvestite. Broken picker. Crippled beyond words. And a chronic liar. Everything out of his mouth was a lie. And you know what? I'm in this fairyland where if he tells me something, I believe it. He's my husband. We're a partnership. We're going to make this work. Forget that I didn't even want to marry him. Delusional thinking? I think so. I used other people for my own personal gains in many, many ways, emotionally, sexually, physically. Any way I could use people to get what I wanted, I did. I committed welfare fraud. I used to steal. You have to realize in those days, and probably still today, when you're on welfare, they don't give you money for paper products. So I would go to the Shell station and steal the toilet paper. And then I would stack those little squares up on the back of my toilet. Make a run every couple times a week, whatever it took to have my toilet paper. I committed burglary. I hooked up with this guy that somehow connected with these prostitutes. Now, the stupid thing was I never asked him how he did that. But how he met these ladies of the night. And how he found out that they had $700 stuffed under their mattress. Now, we were planning to... I was real sharp in those days. Sharper than I am now. Anyway, we decided that we wanted to go to Ensenada for a vacation. Euphemism for spend a week drinking and carousing. And so this is the one story that when we talk about the shame, because I acted at right angle to my value system. I was raised in a church, and so I got my values from that church. You don't steal, you don't murder, you don't commit adultery, you don't do all the stuff I did during my drinking career. And you sure don't steal from prostitutes because of the way they had to earn their money and probably support their families. But my job was to drive the getaway car, Bonnie and Clyde. Except his name wasn't Clyde, but anyway. So I would screech the tires while he was trying to break in the bathroom window. First time didn't work, so I had to do it again. Well, it was my first time at a burglary, you know. Got to practice somewhere. Anyway, he broke in. We stole the $700. We went to Ensenada, and we drank for a week. Now, we played, and we met another couple. It was their idea that we do a foursome or change partners or whatever. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. Not that I wouldn't have. I just didn't like the way he looked. Well, you got to have some measure stick. That is the worst. When I did a four step and I looked at my life, I was devastated that out of pure selfishness, I helped perpetrate that burglary. And I thought about those women and all that money and all they had to do to get that money. And I thought about if they had children they were trying to support. And I was just devastated knowing that I had participated in that. Not only participated in the burglary, but in the week in Ensenada. There were other illegal behaviors, driving under the influence and blackouts. I never drove with my son in the car when I was drunk, but it's because I dumped him on my now ex-husband. But I dumped him on my husband, thinking at the time, see, this is the delusional thinking, that he was being cared for, that I provided care for him so I could go and do what I wanted to do. And the truth was, I just dumped him. I took money from the family budget. I repeatedly lied to both husbands. I would pick fights with my husband so I could go out and party. Well, I think that list is over. I may remember a few more things. Oh, yes, there's a second page. The one thing I also did with that second husband is I would leave my son and him, and I'd go partying, but I refused to tell him where I was going because I didn't want him to know what I was doing. Like he didn't know. You know, I don't know whether that's denial is what it is, but I didn't want him to know. And one night I went out, and I wasn't carousing. I went, met a girlfriend at a Mexican restaurant close to my home, but my son got up in the middle of the night, and he walked into the wall and split his head open. Because my husband was his stepdad, they would not sew him up because they didn't have my permission. Fortunately, he called the restaurant, and they were able to catch me in the parking lot, and I was able to go home and take care of business. And that was in early sobriety. I'm still hanging over on to old behaviors. Now, how did I get into AA? Well, I backed in the door. My girlfriend, her name was Kathy, and I don't know if Kathy's still with us or not. I like to think she is. She said to me one day, Patty, I think I got a problem with drinking, and I'm going to go to AA, but I'm afraid to go alone. Would you go with me? I'm a good friend. I drank with her. She needed to go. Clearly, she needed to go. And so for 5 months, I went to AA with her. I went to 2 meetings a day. I never said a word to a soul. I never shook any hands. I just sat there, and I didn't drink in between. My mother calls. Now, my father has passed away. And my mother calls and said, I've become engaged to my friend. And I had met her friend, but when she introduced Jim as her friend, my mother having sex, God, I went, you know, no. Down here, friend means friend. You might hold hands, but you go on dates, but no. And so she calls and says, I'm engaged. Would you come to the engagement party? And I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to have to bury my father. I mean, I'm going to have to really let go of him so I can have room in my heart for this friend, you know, and who I wasn't particularly impressed with. But, hey, it was my mother's choice, right? So I planned to get drunk. And it was the first time that I talked my husband into taking my son and I out to this new restaurant. I got drunk on my ass, margaritas left and right. I was slurring my speech, having difficulty maneuvering the stairs. And it was the first time I was drunk in front of my son. It was also the last time. Now, I was hungover pretty good the next day, and on Monday, I was in San Bernardino. I got sober in Riverside, California at an Alano Cup, and it had we care in big old letters on the side of the building. And I remember going past that building and saying, bullshit, nobody cares. Nobody cares. I don't know what that's about. And that was 2 years before I entered that building and got sober. So on Monday, I'm driving around San Bernardino on a one-way street, and I stop at a light, and I look over, and here's this folding sign that says, we open at 6 a.m. I'm thinking, oh, okay. What opens at 6 a.m.? I look and I go, oh, it's a bar, far out. I can get drunk before work. Delusional thinking. I start drinking, I ain't going to work. You know, but in my mind, oh, yeah, I can get drunk and then go to work. Yeah, right. And that would never happen. So I go another block and I go, oh, wait a minute. That's kind of alcoholic thinking. I go another block. I'm hitting all the lights, so I'm having time to think. And the third light, I said, you know what, sweetheart? You better get your butt to a meeting. You better raise your hand, and you better just toe the line. So for 2.5 years, well, the first month, you raise your hand, I'm patting an alcoholic, and that's how I joined. There I am. It's just the way everybody else does. But I never said a word to another soul. I never stuck out my hand. I did not have a sponsor. Now, some of you in here know that I'm involved in the sponsor-sponsee luncheon in Bakersfield. And that's why that's so critical to me. I shouldn't be alive. I should not be here. But finally, I did. Well, there was a man. I got to tell you the story of this man. He was a real tall dude. 5'1". No. I'm maybe 4'11". He stands in the doorway of this Solano Club at the end of the meeting. And I couldn't get out. He is standing there looking at me, and he got his hand out. And he said, hi, I'm so-and-so. I looked up at him like, you better get the hell out of my way. Don't you know who I am? I don't want to connect with you. So I take his hand, and I throw it up and went under his arm and went out. Never said a word to him. Not a word. To this day, I've never said a word to him. He may be dead. I don't know. There was another guy. That was the first connection with anybody in that room. I have to realize I got sober a long time ago, and there were 3 women and 60 men in there. And I remember sitting there looking around going, oh, yeah, that's nice. Mm, yeah, that's pretty. Yeah, real nice. And God said to me, you don't mess with these men. And I went, okay, well, the world's full of men. Who cares? And I didn't. Well, I broke the rule once, and that was enough for me. I didn't need to break it again. No, I got a quicker learner after I got sober. 2.5 years, no sponsor, no connection, just meetings twice a day, and didn't drink in between. I started to nut up. I mean, nut up. I was way crazy. And I went to my friend Kathy and I said, I'm nutting up. I don't know what's wrong with me. And in the most loving and kind voice, she said to me, Patty, you might try doing it AA's way instead of your way. Moment of clarity. I said, yeah, that's a good idea. Do you have a sponsor? I said to her. She said, yeah. I said, could I have her name and phone number? That was the best I could do. And I went home and I called that woman. Now, what you have to realize is I've been planning to murder a man for a year in my sobriety. And I knew it was going to cost me $3,500 and I'd start saving money. I almost had it. I look so innocent, don't I? It's just scary. And I knew who to hire. I knew how to do this. And I knew that was really crazy thinking. Because you know what he did to deserve me murdering him or hiring it done? Because I didn't want to get my fingers dirty. He pissed me off. That's all he did. I mean, that's pretty sad. He just pissed me off. It wasn't like he ran me off the road or, I mean, you know, just stole my husband or what. He just pissed me off. And I called this woman. She said, oh, yes, I'd love to meet with you. Come to my home. And I went out to her home in Hemet, California. And her husband was home, so she and I went in the bedroom and said in her, whoops, sorry, Mike, wherever you are. We sat in the middle of her big king-size bed. It was the first king-size bed I'd ever seen. And you know, I'm short, so it looked enormous. And here we are sitting up in her bed, and she said, well, tell me about yourself. I said, well, I'm going to murder this guy. Now, a rational person would just simply ask me to leave her home. But she didn't, nor did she say, well, let's just stop and start with step one. She knew this was pretty serious. If I had come all the way to Hemet, and the first things out of my mouth were, I'm going to murder this guy. And I said, I know it's crazy thinking. I know it. I don't want to spend my life in prison. I want to watch my son grow up. I want to raise my son. This is nuts. And I said, I've done some writing, and I've been wanting to try and make amends to this guy. And she said, oh, well, what's prevented you? I said, every time I think about it, I want to kill him. I mean, I just can't get past the part I want to kill him. So I said, I need to make amends to him. I was mean. I was rude. I was cruel. And I'm planning to kill him. And so she said, okay, well, let's talk about how you make those amends. I said, okay. And she said, why don't you just say I'm sorry for my past actions and attitudes? I thought, oh, man, that's freaking brilliant. Wait a minute. Let me write this down. I want to get it word for word because that makes sense to me. It was like the light came on. And so then we got to the part, I'm going to write him a letter, because I knew I couldn't see him. I mean, it was just beyond my ability at the time. So I wrote, "Dear so-and-so, I'm sorry for my past actions and attitudes." And I said, "Well, how do I sign it? Sincerely, best regards." "No, love." I went, "Love? What are you talking about? Love? I hate this guy." She goes, "If you can't give him your love, give him God's." And I said, "No sweat off my back. I don't even believe in God. No, nothing defiant about me. Nothing angry about me. Remember, God's a man in the church that I'm raised in. And everything that falls from that sexual abuse, I'm pissed. How dare? Where was God when I needed him?" Right? Well, I didn't get killed. I could look at it that way. And I could have, because my half-brother was a psychopath. And he did try to kill me. He threw me in the lake when I was 2 1/2. I could not swim. My mother, who did not swim either, had to go out and feel around till she found my hair and pulled me up. So I have a little claustrophobia, as you might wonder. I don't like closed places, dark and scary and wet. So here we are. I said, "Well, I can write love." And I wrote it out, and I went straight to the post office box as soon as I got home, and I mailed it. And I was free of that obsession. Right then, right there. And I went, "Oh, wait a minute. Maybe this program works. Maybe everything they've been saying actually works." Now, I go along, and I'm meeting with a sponsor, and about 9 months into our relationship, she moves out of town. She develops breast cancer and dies. But she was there for me. Just that little bit of time, she was there for me. And I started thinking that maybe I needed a higher power, maybe. So I said, "All right, one day I'm home alone. I'm going to go in the closet, and I'm going to get on my knees." And I did. I went in that closet, and I got on my knees, and this, and I hope it doesn't offend anyone, was my prayer, because it was also the best I could do. "All right, you son of a bitch, you have my attention. What do you want?" Barely defiant at the time. And you know what happened? I heard a voice, and the voice said, "Welcome back, daughter. I have missed you." And I thought, "Whoa, shit." Yeah, I mean, you would think the lights came on, the wings of the angels. No, no. I got up and got the hell out of that closet. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was gone. But it did not leave me, that experience. "Welcome back, daughter. I have missed you." Boy, talk about being loved by a higher power. And it also meant that higher power, and this is my understanding, knew everything I had done and still could say that to me. Wow. I didn't deserve that. Uh-uh. On a human level, I deserve what that guy was going to get. You know, boom, boom, bye-bye, baby girl. That was my experience with God in the beginning. And now remember, I have trouble trusting. I have trouble believing. I have trouble with security and safety. So I say to God, "Look, I'm going to start praying for things and see what happens here. Because I need to test you. See if you really, that was that voice." So I prayed. This is so funny. when I think about it now, it's hysterical. I prayed for parking spaces at the front door to whatever place I was going to. And I got them. At the mall, at the grocery store, at the post office, wherever I went, Sears and Roebuck, everywhere, right at the front door. Now, if this went on for a month, okay, maybe there's a God. It went on for a year. And if I think to pray today, I get a parking place. But you know what? I had a little conversation with God and I said, I'm a doubting Patty. Forget doubting Thomas. I'm a doubting Patty. And I need to know, I need some evidence of your existence. I have to have that in my heart. And please give me a sign that I will know that you're real and that you love me. What I get are feathers. And I get all kinds of feathers. I get little tiny ones, itty bitty ones, and I get eagle feathers. I get feathers. The other day, I was writing a grant, and it was a very difficult process, and it was two very intense weeks. And we submitted it on Thursday. On Friday morning, I go into my garage, and I lifted the garage door up, and I looked down, and there was this little pile of feathers. And it was like God saying, thank you. Thank you for your service this week, Patty. Thank you for following my lead. Thank you that you are my servant. And that's my job. I want to talk a little bit about, I want to tell you a story about that same kind of issue, and that issue was to suit up and show up. I was supposed to be speaking at a professional group, and as is my habit, I got to pee before I speak because, God forbid, that I have to pee in the middle of my speech. So I go into the bathroom, and I'm the only one in there, and I'm doing my business, and a lady walks in, and she's sobbing. She's crying hard. And I'm in this stall going, crap. In my family, you cry, you take care of yourself. Nobody reaches out, puts their arm around you unless you're bleeding. And so here's a stranger in there crying her eyes out. Now, I got to get out because I got to speak, right? So I figured, okay, well, I'll go on out, wash my hands, which I did. She's sobbing. I'm thinking, my God, what am I going to do here? Now, you have to realize that I'm a therapist. Now, the reason that's funny, because if she had been in my office, I'd have comforted her. I would have talked with her. But I'm in a public restroom, and she's sobbing. And I dried my hands and started to leave. And God said, you going to break the rule or not? The family rule. And I turned back to this woman and I said, honey, is there anything I can do for you? And I walked toward her. And she said, I'm pregnant with twins. And I just found out they're both dead. And I would have left her. Had I stayed true to that family value, I would have missed the opportunity to put my arms around that hurting woman and stay with her during that process. And I still made it to my speech. And I just remember thinking, my job is to suit up and show up. I don't know what my day has for me. Never. 20 years into my sobriety, I woke up one morning and I went to work, and I was sitting at my desk and I started crying. Now, you have to realize I'm not a crier. I tear up, but I don't really cry, and I'm sure I'm not going to cry in front of you. Even to this day, I have to really say to myself, it's okay to cry. It's okay to release. It's okay to let go. So I go to work, and I'm crying, and I didn't stop all day. Finally, about 3:30, I called the employee assistance program, and I asked for help. I'm a therapist, I know, right? So I asked for help, and I got to see a psychiatrist on Friday. Now, this was Wednesday. I went into such a severe depression that I could not see color. I could not feel God's presence. There was nothing humorous, and I have a kind of a twisted sense of humor, so I like to, you know, things crack me up. Nothing. And I was suicidal. 20 years of sobriety, thousands of meetings, friends galore in AA, and I'm suicidal. As a therapist, I peddle hope and the possibility of life. And here I was wanting to kill myself, and I wanted to kill myself for 2.5 years every day. The only thing that kept me from doing it was all those meetings I had set in. And knowing that every client that had ever sat in front of me would know that I had died hopeless. And I couldn't do it. It kept me from not committing suicide. Now, I'm on medication. I'm doing everything they tell me to do. I'm hanging on. Oops, sorry. Gets closer every minute. I come out of this depression, finally. 3 months afterwards, my higher power begins to use me again. Because I can now hear him again. I can see color again. And what happens is I get pegged to sit on a committee that writes policy and procedure at the state level in Alaska. I lived in Alaska for 30 years. For families and friends and clients of individuals with alcoholism and mental illness. And that's what I got to do. And I would have never understood the mental illness without having gone through that dark night of the soul. So if you're out there and you're hopeless today, hang on. Let's talk about the benefits of sobriety, because there's so many. Oh my gosh. First of all, my higher power. And the love that I know that I experience from that higher power, the guidance I get from my higher power. My higher power gives me peace of mind. I feel peaceful setting in my prayer and meditation. I often call my higher power Great Spirit, because it has to be bigger than the church I was raised in. It has to be. I remember hearing a rabbi talk about grief, and one of the things, I only got 10 minutes of his talk, and in that 10 minutes he said, God is bigger than your anger. And I remember thinking, whoa, astounding. God is bigger than my anger, because I knew I had a powerful lot of anger. And that was his gift to me that day, was the God, my God had to be bigger than a church building, than it had to be bigger. And it is bigger for me, huge. I have a worldwide family of alcoholism and alcoholics, and I have my dear sponsor that I love very much. I have I sponsor others because that service I get to be a part of today. I belong today. For years, and Melissa was talking about this, for years, I was certain I was adopted. Forget the fact that I looked exactly like my mother. But I was real sure I had been adopted. And it took years and years for me to be okay with me. Now, I've got my innocence back. I learned how to forgive. I have forgiven those men. Now, I didn't forget what they did, because it's from that that I have learned how to have healthy relationships and healthy boundaries. I know who I want in my life, and I know who I don't want in my life. And I am grateful for that, and I feel no guilt either way. And what I've noticed is only those people who support me in the Spirit of God are the ones that are around me. And every once in a while, I want to float through, you know, and I think, oh, okay, God, I thought I had that taken care of. Guess I get another lesson. That's okay, because the sooner I look for the solution, the faster we're out of that. And that is a wonderful gift. My medication last August, after 20 years on the same medications for my mental illness, were changed, and I had to titrate off, and it took 3 months to get off the old meds. Pretty rough time. And I knew it was okay because I knew God was walking with me every step of that way. My mother knew about the sexual abuse. I was in my mid-50s when I found out she knew. And it was 8 years after she died that she came to me. And I said, Mama, why didn't you leave him? She said, I separated you kids from your father. I stood between you. You have to realize it was the time right after World War II. Women didn't get paid anything. You couldn't, babysitting, food, car. I couldn't do it. So I stayed and I stood between you. And she did. Because I even remember saying that to my brother. Mom stands between us and Dad. Because I didn't have the memories of the sexual abuse until I had 8 years of sobriety. That's how suppressed they were. Rebecca Alonso, who is not one of us, stated in her book, now, day after day, I have the choice to forgive the two men who took so much from me, or I can choose to wallow in a toxic brew of bitterness. I choose to live in forgiveness today. I choose to live in the light today. I choose to walk in that light and to serve God. Now, come June, I'll be divorced 30 years. And that's a long time. And believe me, one of the first things I had to do when I hit Bakersfield, because there's cowboys in Bakersfield. Tight-ass jeans, cowboy boots. You know, I had to pray. And I had to turn relationships over to my higher power, and I put it in my prayer box. And guess what? They're not lined up. So my job is to forget about that and to concentrate on service. Service to my community, service to AA, service to God. End of story. There's a Mark Hall song. It says, there's freedom in surrender. When you're on your knees and answers seem so far away, you're not alone. Stop holding on and just be held. I want to thank my AA family for holding me when I needed holding and showing me a life of freedom, love, and humility, which I could have never found on my own. Thank you.